big tablets change Russian dungeons. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is GeekSpeak, a technology show about society. With me in the air room is Miles Elam. He's a programmer, pedantic dude, political junkie, and farmer.
Yeah.
But you're really a full-time programmer.
Yep.
Yeah. And thank you for joining me in my new, not really completed, home studio.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of blankets hanging up on the wall for sound dampening.
And you know, I can hear that I don't have enough of them. So bear with us as I remodel a bit of my home and hopefully fix that power plug so you can plug in your laptop. But let's keep going so we don't run out of juice. Hey, Miles, tell me about big hard drives and your concern.
One of my concerns in that have come up is that hard drives are becoming so large, it's hard to back them up. Back in the days, you know, dating ourselves here, of 250 megabyte hard drives or 500 megabyte hard drives, you could back up, once they were available anyway, onto a CD-ROM, a CDR. Or you could back up to a tape drive, which was also quite common. But now that hard drives are truly gargantuan, when they're hitting that 5, 8, 10, 12 terabyte level, the only way you back up is you get a second hard drive and back that up. And it really added a level of anxiety for me to say, wow, I have all of this data from basically the start of my digital life as you move from hard drive to hard drive. Am I going to lose everything here all in one shot? You know? And as it turns out, these new hard drives, these 10 terabyte hard drives, are actually lasting quite a while.
Is that data or is that just your own speculation?
This is one where the company Backblaze, they're a storage company that has done a couple of these studies before. They've published their results for different hard drive models, what their annualized failure rate is.
Like I love it when big companies like this do that. Yeah.
How many drives they have, how many failures they've had of each model. And so you can see the ones that are just failing. But it's funny, as I'm looking at this chart, and you can find it on our website to see for yourself, that...
And that website's what, Miles?
Geekspeak.org.
Oh, good, good. Go on.
As you look through the drive size, you know, the 3 terabyte, 4 terabyte drives from the past, they had a, you know, there were some good ones, some bad ones. They were not doing all that well. Although they have been around for much longer. As you start getting into the 5, 8, 12 range, the numbers start changing. And it's not just due to the age of the drives. They really are becoming more reliable. And they've been testing against the enterprise drives versus consumer rated drives.
Sure.
And the enterprise drives aren't really any better in terms of longevity. They've been finding them to be, you know, comparable.
Miles, to alleviate your concern, I mean, you, I'm assuming, have redundancy in your backup situations, right?
Right now, I just have a backup solution.
But do you have two backup solutions or just one?
Just one.
So if that hard drive loses a capacitor, what do you do?
I back up my laptop again on our new hard drive.
Okay, so you have your laptop and you have a backup of that laptop. But what about like old photos and stuff that wouldn't fit on your laptop? Or does everything fit on your laptop?
Everything fits on my laptop.
Okay, so your laptop has two hard drives because you got the older Mac.
And yeah, I don't take as many photos as you do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the redundancy I have is multiple NAS systems. And then, of course, Google Cloud backup for photos. These are the things I'm concerned about the most. Mm-hmm. And then Dropbox for also other redundancy, you know, for files that I care about. But I'm always concerned because my desire to make sure I never lose anything causes me to have duplication, which is never cleaned up. And so my NASs have multiple copies of files. But also on Dropbox, I have things like the paperwork and I just last bought my house is on that thing, which has like all my account information that I was sending to the bank is on my Dropbox account, which obviously is a very bad idea because if anybody gets into my Dropbox account, they have my identity. And Equifax does that job.
Yeah. Honestly, I'd love it to be able to have the equivalent of a time capsule, something like that, in two locations, like one at my mother's house and one at my house.
Why not do that?
Because Time Machine doesn't really
connect
up to you. It's expected that you have one drive that you're backing up to, and that's it.
Well, it's nice to know that the hard drives are better and more reliable and last longer.
You still need to do backups.
But you still need to have duplicate copies. I mean, it's essential. It concerns me when people don't. So get on that, man.
Well, I do. Okay. I have the working copy and I have the backup.
All right. So Facebook is kind of correcting a story that they released earlier in the year.
I don't know about the correction. I guess I haven't been following it that closely.
Yeah, I recall. Well, go ahead and tell your story. I'll tell you what I remember.
Facebook has been linked with Russian ads. They have even gone so far as to say they were blocking all ads from RT, Russia Today, that network of news organizations. And now they've released data about how many people saw those Russia-linked political posts. 126 million Americans.
126 million.
Right. And there are something like 350 million Americans currently, and many of them are children. So it hit quite a few of the adults of America. If someone saw at least a few of them.
Yeah, the story that we did in September talked about 3,000 Russian bot ads that Facebook was bringing forward and such. But you're right, that I think that was how many individual ads that were purchased.
Right.
And that they pulled in like $100,000 in ads to and associated with like 470 Facebook phony Facebook ads. So this story seemed a lot less dire than that many millions of – how many – what was the number you had again?
126 million.
Yeah, that seems like a lot of ads. I'm assuming that's how many views occurred.
No, it's how many people saw the ads.
Yeah, that
not
makes
how
sense.
Many
okay.
distinct ads.
Gotcha.
Twitter back in last September, or sorry, this September, they had said that they had a tally of about 201 accounts that were linked to Russian operatives. They have since revised that to say 2,752. So
accounts that are that way?
Yes.
Interesting.
Individual accounts. And Google has said that they have found what they say is a dollar amount. Just curious how each of them counts different things. Facebook is ad impressions, how many people have seen an ad. Twitter counts by accounts, and Google counts by dollars, saying that it found that $4,700 in ad spending was done by
So it's hard to compare all of these at some level.
Right.
But I will link to the other episode of Geek Speak that we actually chatted with the same topic. Do you think it's something we need to be concerned about?
I think it's something that we needed to be concerned about when the election was going on. Now it's kind of a done deal, and it's more dismaying than anything else when you find out that things were manipulated in such a way. But, the president is now the president.
I think the general concerns around knowledge transfer in a new age is a serious one. I mean, we've always been a species that, changes over time. We've been changing drastically society for a long time, and this is the newest stage of that. And I'm assuming that legislation and society will catch up at some point.
I was actually thinking this hasn't been for a long time.
Well, it's been a long time from the perspective of our lifespans.
Yeah, but that's
and we
really
had the
short.
Print, we had the printing press, right?
I think of the Revolutionary War. The folks in that time had more in common with people who grew up in the Roman Empire than they do with us.
Sure.
Like
But they did have newspapers.
Yes, they did. They had their printing press. That is true. But the fastest way you could get anywhere was the speed
Personal
of a horse.
Yeah, sure.
Of instantaneous, communication was still, not really an option.
Well, let's talk about your next story and a bit about, since we're both parents, we care about this topic a little bit.
A finding from Common Sense Media's National Media Use by Kids Census, they found that up from 1% in 2011 of Americans under 8 have their own tablet. Today, it's 42% of kids under 8 have their own tablet.
Under 8 own their own tablet.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, ownership is a weird thing just because, little kids don't
technically
buy
anything.
Them. Yeah, but
when you say that to your 12-year-old daughters, they're not happy with you. You say, no, you don't really own anything. Yeah, that doesn't work really well.
The thing is, they may have bought something for him. Zoe hasn't really bought anything for
herself. A child doesn't own anything, technically, right? Yeah. The guardians own the things the child owns. It's not something I'd rub in their face unless I'm pissed off.
My daughter has her own tablet.
Yeah. And she's under eight. And do you still monitor and control how much media time she uses that tablet? Or is it a free-for-all?
I do monitor.
Yeah.
It's also a very different thing being technically savvy and giving your child this.
Why is that?
To a large extent, a lot of technology ends up being this open black box. Like how people use their phones is how they perceive that's how people would use it. You have this open thing that you give to someone and they use it however.
You assume they're using it the same way you would use it.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily know the nuances of security or user accounts. Like that doesn't really come into play unless you have worked in terms of security, unless you've worked with like sysadmin or something outside of computers that would give you that experience. And so for me, it was natural to take a Kindle Fire tablet and say, okay, now what accounts are on there? Okay, each of them has a PIN number. So if my wife wants to get on it, she has her PIN number and I have my PIN number.
That's a nice feature. I wish Apple had that feature. They have that they actually have that exact same feature of multiple accounts on iPads for the educational space, but it's not available unless you have an educational account.
Ah.
Yeah.
And then for the kids, you can specify it as a kid profile so it doesn't act like a normal one. And there
you're restricting what apps can run and such.
Right.
Yeah. You can do this on iOS as well. You can set up restrictions.
But you don't really have profiles on iOS.
You don't have profiles, right. So you set up prescriptions. And so people do this kind of hackery where you can unlock the restrictions whenever you want, right? So that the parent can switch to. But it's hard to do, and so people don't really do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have set that up. And so my daughter can go in, and she has her choice of like a drawing program. And, like if she wants to draw as much as she wants on this tablet, that's great. Fine by me. And
does she have YouTube access?
She does not have YouTube access. There was a YouTube Kids that was released, and I found it to be the idea was we're going to curate this so you don't have
the
worst
on there.
We'll
make a safe space. Yes.
And what I found it to be was just a bunch of repetitive, banal, useless items.
With ads.
Yeah. And it was just not worth it.
Yeah.
And so the things that I are left with are the drawing apps, the PBS Kids. I'm a big booster.
That's
of that.
A great,
I love that.
Great app,
And that I do limit, like how much time. I don't want her in front of the TV the entire time. But at the same time, it's like, this is.
You know, I got to say though that most likely you're being more attentive than most kids that have. You know, most 42% of Americans that have tablets under 8. I bet more adults are more lenient than you are, or
it depends.
Less controlling.
I probably give my child more screen time than I should.
Well, that's just a feeling of a guilty parent.
I debate this
all the time, of course, because my job is to make children content on Netflix compelling to children. Like, that's my job, right? And so I spend a lot of time doing that, programming it, talking in meetings, figuring out what's interesting and engaging, traveling around the world, watching kids use the content, learning about what works.
Can I give you an idea for Netflix to do?
What do you want? Like volume control on something?
No. I would like interstitials in between programs in much the same way as ABC used to do with the Bod Squad back when
little educational pieces?
Yeah.
Like what would they do?
So
you're watching some show and then it ends and then, hey, did you know that drinking water is good? Drink water, not like, soda, that kind of thing.
Yeah, don't drown your food. You know, thing they call me yuck mouth. You remember those ones way back in the day?
Sure.
I have a great amount of love for those, and also like Schoolhouse Rock and things like that. These little snippets that last for 30 seconds or less that just give a little nugget of information on the way to the next episode.
Yeah. All right, I will share that with my colleagues.
Like I would cool. I would love that for my kid. Like I would love that shared tradition of things. And quite honestly, when we had to learn the preamble to the Constitution when I was in fifth or sixth grade, I knew it already because sang the song from Schoolhouse Rock.
You know, I think it would be – that's a perfect Hack Day project for me to work on where it's the parent finds videos that they want their kid to experience because they experienced as a childhood and injects it into their feed of their kids' content. And they'd be really a good hack day project. I mean, the trick about one of all these kinds of things is that, and you see this with YouTube Kids, right? Or is it, is that what the app was called? The decision of what gets curated is the corporation or it's the parent, right? If you say, well, I trust – you're doing PBS Kids because you trust PBS Kids because everything you've seen so far, they're doing a good job and it works for you. You might want to expand your daughter's experience with media above and beyond what PBS Kids is. Yeah. But you know that you can hand the thing to her and she can just go for it and it's okay because there's a curation going on there. But that curation might be not fit you perfectly. So like the YouTube one didn't fit you perfectly, right? There was stuff on there that was
banal. Well, that's the thing though. The YouTube Kids, I don't believe was truly curated. I think it was more along the lines of we had an allow list. These are things that are allowed. But there wasn't anything that said that this is actually useful or educational or
so, not. So the trick around that is how do you become a safe spot for children, have the parents feel good about it, but also not make the parents be the arbitrators and the managers of this, because one of the things that parents are doing when they put their device in front of the kid is, oh God, I gotta do the dishes, I gotta get dinner ready, I gotta do the laundry. Like there's all these other, I gotta help the older kid with homework. So you're kind of like using it as a bit of a babysitter, and it's okay because it's just that screen time and it gets you to do these other things. So it's not really, you never really want to spend time setting that up for your kid because you don't really want your kid to be on it anyways. It's an odd dichotomy.
Right. There is something that I want to give a shout out to. I have in the past, but the Super Y app is awesome.
Super Y?
Yeah. Because
isn't that a PBS Kids thing?
That is PBS Kids as well, but I mean, this is a, there's a special app that, I mean, my daughter's in kindergarten now, and I installed the app, I think, when she had started TK. And the idea is...
What's TK?
Transitional kindergarten. So like a preschool.
That didn't exist when I was a kid.
Yeah. But basically it has like letter tracing.
Mm-hmm. You know, and, oh, that's the one you're talking
then,
about. Yeah,
yeah, and then goes through and you have an outline and it's drawn with dots. And the dots are the letters of the alphabet. So you have to go through the alphabet and touch each one in order to do the whole
shape. The order, yeah. So it's like a connect the dots, but you have to know, but you have to know your ABCs to do
right.
it.
Right. You have images of pictures of items scrolling across the screen, and you have to touch the item that begins with the displayed letter.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know, like, oh, what does that sound? It sounds like it starts with a K. Like,
I've always wondered if that space in app development is profitable, or if it, you know, what, because more than times that are the ones that are successful have successful IP, intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
So like Super Y is a relatively popular show, and so when they produce an app that has educational features in it, people know about it because of Super Y, and then it's nice because it's an educational type app. Which, of course, it's hard to claim educational on that age set because that age set isn't actually taking tests. So it's hard. You don't have background information
right.
on whether it's viable.
But I do see the effect of, you know, having the Princess Presto section where it's saying, press the letter that that sounds like, and seeing my daughter go and bloop, hit the M. I'm like,
perfect.
I'm watching the results of this.
Yeah, definitely. Well, this kind of leads in a bit to our longer form story today. And this is triggered actually from a longtime listener of the show, John.
Hi, Miles and Lyle. Your show has really changed over the years, and much of that change reflects broader trends in the industry. At the same time, the loss of KOSB makes it virtually impossible to host the kind of show where individuals call in and get their questions answered. What I would like to hear you discuss on the podcast is the change of focus from individuals to big corporations when it comes to innovation. Has the PC, personal computer after all, ceased to be a tool which empowers individuals to be creative? Is it now just a glorified terminal to permit access to sites and services on the internet? Are the days when you could give your child a computer and he or she could use it to build something, a game, program, novel, artwork, whatever, and turn it into a successful business or revenue stream over? A particular interest to me is artificial intelligence and machine learning. Are things like generative adversarial networks, GANs, only valuable to big tech companies? Tech's Frightful Five, they got us a link we'll put up on our website. Or is there hope for a bright individual with a computer at home to profit in some small way? Thoughts?
John. From John. So let's first cover the early part for listeners that are new to the show. We used to broadcast on KOSP, a FM radio station in Santa Cruz. That radio station has gone out of business because internets and other things. But in general, it's because of the change of technology over time. And we started as a call-in tech show in 1998, and we've been on air
since then. The Cruise.io folks were in 1998. Yeah. We started in 2000.
September 2000. And you in November 2000? I think so.
No, I think you started in August and I started in September.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've been doing a long time. And it used to be a call-in show. It was a half an hour show where we basically answered people's tech calls. And then slowly over time, I morphed it away from that so we could talk about broader topics. We got into an hour-long format. And now, of course, we're a podcast for years and we do any format we want. However, calling in now is much trickier because when we had the radio station, we were live. And when you're live broadcasting FM, inviting calls is just invite calls. And the phone rings and someone answers and we're done.
Especially because we had few different folks over the years answer the phone calls, screen them, and you know, give us the most compelling ones, and give us some headway, give us some leadway ahead of time to say like who's on the call, what are they calling about.
But really, the nature of the live broadcast is the thing that allows the full conversation. Because if Miles and I pique your interest and you want to ask us a question, you're actually listening to a recording that happened days before. So you can't actually interact with us live, right? We can, of course, ask you, and we do frequently, to ask us questions. You can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, just like John did, and we'll address your question on air if it's something that we feel like and we can get a good conversation out of. So that part of it's one thing. Now, I have to say that stopping doing phone calls was not because we got off the main FM and stopped broadcasting live. It's because we got done doing tech calls.
And well, that and we lost our phone answer. That kind of coincided.
It did at some level. Yeah, I guess you're right. But, I mean, I was very okay with not doing tech calls anymore on the radio. And the reason is that they get a little repetitive because the technology problems that exist seem to persist for a while. You know, how do I get my printer to work? Why is it running out of ink? That kind of complaint stuff that happens. And it's the truth is, most of what we were doing is doing good Google searches and having fun answering it, which can be fun. And we used to do them every once in a while, even after Rick left.
Yeah, and I do miss the call-ins. I miss the feedback.
The connection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I don't necessarily miss the number of times we had to answer, how do you get your printer connected?
Yeah, and is it plugged in, that kind of thing.
Right. Although that was fairly early on. Those actually stopped later on. We started getting more
existential ones. But one of the things that we've seen, and the reason why there's so many complications and questions of that nature, is that as we have seen over the program, over the years of this show, I mean, when we first did this show, understanding serial interrupts was important for a home person to have a printer working. Like it was, things were bad. And they've gotten better. We saw USB come along, right, and make things a lot better during the length of the show. And with that became a mainstream quality of the technology we're talking about. Everybody uses a computer. Everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket. It's just the standard now. And all the things that used to be really, really challenging are a lot easier. There are still, of course, technical problems. But in some ways, you don't have to be a technical expert to engage in social media, online video, even editing video and posting it, even doing creative stuff online.
Yeah, the fun part is when we started the show, the web was kind of old hat for us in a way because we had been doing it for 5 years, you know, 4 or 5 years at that time. And it was like, yeah, we're the experts because that was the amount of time that anyone had with that. And as time went on, it became, a lot of people know how to do web development. So we weren't that voice telling you how it worked.
Right. And things came about. Like, first off, if someone comes to me right now and says, you know, I have beaded necklaces I want to sell, I'm not going to tell them to make a website. I'm going to say, go get on Etsy. Right? Like, services came around that fulfilled the need for an individual's desire. Making a website for your store right now? No, don't bother. Get a Facebook page. And get on the media spaces that already exist. It's a lot easier. Or, you know, go to some space that makes a website for you, like Wix or Squarespace.
But this raises the question that John was saying. Is there a space now for someone to learn about technology and still be able to, you know, make a living?
Yeah, the discussion was really about the PC, the personal computer, and whether you can still hand the personal computer to somebody and have them be creative on it. And yes, I think you can.
Well, my daughter, 5 years old, is drawing on her tablet and constantly making pictures, and I'm watching the pictures that she draws become more and more complex, more and more nuanced, more and more varied, which is always gratifying for a parent to see. And it's also interesting that I can save them and we can look at them. It used to be you had a big piece of poster paper and your child would draw on them, and then you try to keep them, but for the most part, it just took up a lot of space. Now it's just like most photos. You take a whole bunch of photos and you just keep them around forever. Now it's my child's drawings. I just keep them forever.
We keep a large set of the drawings on paper. And then if I ever toss any of my kids' stuff that I toss, I just take a photo on my phone. Like, it's easy, right? Then it's captured. I'll probably never look at it again, but it's there. But the question is there more space for innovation? Is there still the same amount of space for innovation for individuals versus corporations? Is there some kind of like shift to corporation ownership of innovation on computers and the internet? And I don't think that's at all the case. We are seeing a lot more creativity being done by large corporations, a lot more of the innovation happening and presented to us as by large corporations. But when it comes down to it, there's still individual people doing amazing things.
Yeah, you can't solve the same problems that were solved 20 years ago.
Right.
But you can still learn how the technology works and solve new problems that arise.
I mean, it's definitely true that we saw a growth, actually over the span of this program, we've seen a change in the way things emerge. You know, Google emerged during this program, right? Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, really, when it comes down to it, Google is
the CD-ROM tries to emerge. Sure. It came and went.
But, you know, Google is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. It's not like it was a corporation born from nowhere. It was two people that started doing their thesis project on search engines that made a company that is now an extremely successful company. And it's not – another person can still do that. I don't feel like there's any blockage of that. It's just that we had a giant explosive growth, and now we have, you know, the big five, if you will, at some level. And when he says the big five, I'm assuming he means – Facebook, Google, Microsoft,
Apple, Amazon.
Amazon, yeah, okay. I mean, I'm guessing, but that makes sense. Is Microsoft even in there?
Yeah, sure. Microsoft's still one of the big ones.
And it's true that they're doing a lot of the development. They're spending a lot of the money in the space, and they're supporting the entire structure of our society being online in a lot of ways. But I think right now, a person with some dedication and time can think of a relatively good idea or a copy of a good idea, spend energy and time implementing it, and make a living from it. I don't feel like there's a stopping point for that. Right. Just like there's always been an opportunity for someone to design a new chair and manufacture it in a garage and sell them and make money off of it.
Yeah, there are also areas that have always been popular and will remain so, like games. The games that are made by the AAA, the high-budget ones, are always going to be there and probably out of the reach of most people. But then you also have the very simple games that come out all the time that become big hits. Like 2048 comes to mind. That was a very simplistic game. Candy Crush is not a particularly complex game.
But the execution of Candy Crush was done by a big company, right?
It was,
right?
Yeah. But I'm talking about it, they don't all have to be the, you know, crazy Skyrim, huge world, beautifully rendered setup. They can be the basic fun game. Those are still available and out there and things that you can do. There is always a limit as to what you can do as an individual.
And there always has been.
Right. When you have a group of people together, you're always going to be able to do more than one person by themselves.
You are listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Miles Elam. And we're talking about technology and society and how things have changed and whether there's still space for people in their garage to make something big and successful, to pay their bills out of the things they've made with technology, or whether corporations have kind of ownership over it. I think the difference really is that, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, everybody that was doing stuff online.
Sorry, the chair is not particularly comfortable.
I think that 15 years ago, everybody that was doing something online had a very short story behind them, right? It was either, you know, Yahoo doing something, or it was individuals doing something new and exciting, you know? I'm thinking the streaming services. Netflix comes online to start streaming at some point, right? And that was exciting. And oh my gosh, the little guys might be able to compete with Blockbuster and stuff. And then those companies just have grown and now are these powerhouses that have changed the way business is going. You know, you see retail stores close down all the time. Thank you, Amazon. You see Blockbuster die. Thank you, Netflix. Like this kind of change of our society that happened over the last 15 years is a drastic change. But when it comes down to it, the state we're currently at and the state we were 15 years ago is not a lot of different for the individual's desire to be creative. If I want to go work for myself and do something that's some kind of service online or delivery of some kind of technology stuff, I do have to compete with Amazon, but at some level, I could probably sell through Amazon a bit. There's more opportunity for me to find customers as an individual than there was before, I think.
Well, you definitely don't have to build from scratch anymore. And that's a major difference.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that's just amazing. Like, if you and I were to do launch a magazine, an online magazine or something right now, the amount of infrastructure we'd have to build to make it work is pretty minimal. Like, we'd know, we'd grab Postgres, we'd probably do Node, and the tools available to, and probably React as the front end system. And those tools are so easy to develop high end, high performance applications that we would invest little time on that kind of baseline thing, and we would see some pretty quick returns on our investment of time and energy. And then the problem space would be just getting good writers. Well, you can write.
Huh? That is an area that I hope, anyway, will start to happen in the future, is you will see a branching off of just straight technology and moving into pulling in the skills from the rest of society. Mm-hmm. When I think of the problems we've had with regard to manipulation of social media, that is an area where when you have to figure out how to curate, how to figure out which content, which conduct is acceptable. That's an area that's been talked about a lot in the social sciences, has been debated for decades.
Sure.
It's a hard problem. They do a lot better. And this is where you have that difference between technology. You know, you can't treat people as though they are an algorithm, because that's not how people aren't logical. Mm-hmm. They follow other patterns. And I'm hoping that you're going to see a renaissance of taking in a lot more of these disciplines and making a more holistic view of how we interact with technology. We do see that already to a large extent with regard to games. I mean, games are visually stunning. They absolutely incorporate human psychology as to what is fun. You know, even if you're not doing it based upon the latest research in sociology, you are still basing it on practices that are deeply rooted into the human experience.
Let me talk about one other piece in the middle of this discussion that John brings up. Is it now just a glorified terminal to permit access to sites and services on the internet? He's talking about the PC. And I think no. But I think that's true for the phone and the tablet. And I really think of these things as different devices. It is true that your phone is a supercomputer in your pocket. It's true that your tablet has all this amazing power. Both these things are much more powerful than the computers that were used to first write Facebook, right? Like, what you could do with the technology in these devices is really kind of amazing. But they're locked down and they're tied up and they're different than a personal computer. They are really different. So you're not giving your daughter a personal computer that allows a lot of breadth. You're giving her a kind of minimized device that is controlled through lots of different providers, like the apps from Super Y, right? This is a different type of interaction of a computer, having a lockdown mobile device.
That's also an age thing.
Sure. I mean, I know they don't give a computer to your daughter when she gets older. But, you know, my kids, the first computers they had were Macs or a Windows machine for my son, or a Linux machine for my son, because he was a little older. But then when my daughters came around, we had Macs. It was just a lot easier. But they did, you know, have some understanding of how the machine works, installing Java to get Minecraft running. So they got a little bit of that going on. But they've since, because they're in school now, their primary computer is now a Chromebook, which isn't a totally locked-down operating system. My son, though, did recently crack it and install Linux on it, which is awesome. But in general, they are using more controlled devices for consumption and not, you know, program creativity. They're easier to use. They have all these wonderful features. But there is a disconnect there. And I do smell that disconnect in John's letter that, yeah, there's a problem there. And I've known this for a while, of course. What do you think about this? You know, most people now have phones. Not everybody has a laptop. Or if they do, they don't use it.
Yes.
Computer.
I would prefer there were fewer Nazis online, for example. But
how does that connect?
I don't think that
is it just a general statement?
It is. I don't think it's a little thing that there is so much content that is coming in through just a phone.
That's a major thing. How does that connect with Nazis online?
Because if you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, you have access to, you know, family photos. You have access to this communication with other people in your life and experiences.
It's amazing.
That I think is amazing, yes. Yeah. And it is not just – and it is not a passive act. People are actively participating engaged, in this conversation.
Connecting to each other.
Right.
But it has been – superficially, right? Isn't that superficial connection?
The thing is, I do believe that we have been looking at our own lives through rose-colored glasses from many years ago. When people say, oh, we're on our phones all the time, just, you know, staring at a phone and doing that, you are many times interacting with other people, even if it's not in person.
Right.
And I do recall when we were younger that a whole lot of people, I mean, what's the archetype of
your kids watching TV all the time?
Well, there's that. There's also the in the morning, you get the morning paper and you're sitting there reading it, you know, or the pictures I've seen of people in the early 1900s
on the train.
Waiting for a train to go by that are all just noses in the newspapers and not interacting with one another.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is that you're saying that the social connection, apart from the Nazis, this is a wonderful benefit because people are connecting with each other more readily. You see information about your aunt who maybe you would normally only see every Thanksgiving or something. Now you're seeing her information all the time and kind of connect with her. So it connects you a bit more. But I would say that even though that connection does have a bit of, has reality to it, is beneficial, it also is not the same as sitting down having a real conversation with a person, right? Because everybody that's kind of posting that way is kind of posting in a public sense.
When you say a real conversation, though, that is showing the bias there of saying somehow the conversation that you have with someone online is not a real conversation. True, it doesn't have the nonverbal communication that you would have otherwise, but it does have that notion of being the written form that you can go back and refer to.
But let's think about the human brain and how it's developed, right? Where we come out of this ape space, we produce small societies of less than 100 people where everyone knows each other and those tribes are interacting with other groups. But basically, the human mind can handle that kind of space. So if you have 100 people on Facebook as your friends, or more like 50 people on Facebook as your friends, and you engage with all of them at some level and kind of aware of them, that is something that can be – that's human. But when you have, I mean, I don't know, 1,000 people as friends on Facebook, and you're seeing the feed coming through, and what you see is mandated by trying to get you to stay on the service longer and therefore intrigue you in some way. Mm-hmm. And so you're being shown a high school friend that you connected with at one point that will show you something that's kind of interesting to you. But it's not really – you can't comprehend the entire space, and that's why Facebook's subject, managing it for you. It's not the same as having a real relationship.
Oh, I did not say it was the same. I just don't believe in the moniker of saying it's not a real conversation. It's a different form of interacting, and it is more curated, although I think of the bar experience, which is where a lot of people, when they weren't on, when you're not on Facebook, that you're going there and you're talking with people. And so you see a lot of the same people, but it's a wide group. And some of the conversations are much more superficial and, booze-addled. That is still a very common interaction, as is the church or synagogue interaction or the mosque or the, going to the park. The park is great because that also has that activity level that goes along with it, but it's still not all of these conversations have ever been the person that is close to you, that core 100 people or 50 yeah. people. It has always been, especially if you live in a city, a more generalized interaction and curated to some extent because public spaces are controlled in a certain way in terms of access, in terms of who has, you know, the ability to get there in locations.
So John goes on to talk about whether, you know, you can produce a revenue stream from your creativity through the internet. And I think that it's been it's as easy as it's ever has and maybe easier to do that. And it's still really hard. It's still really hard to work for yourself and be creative and make a living. We recently did Open Studios, which is kind of a traveling gallery show in Santa Cruz. You go visit people's art spaces and see their work. And it's a lot of people that have just, you know, some of them have just been able to get the hump of being successful enough to support themselves. But most of them are doing this as a second thing, as a hobby, as a mm-hmm. as a creative endeavor. And I think that being creative is not necessarily it's not required to be creative and make a revenue from that. I mean, being creative and making things in the world is just part of being a human being. It's not that you have to translate that into any kind of money. And I think we've seen a revolution in the makerspace, in giant ways intellectually funded by the internet, such that it's really easy to learn how to do new things. If you want to learn how to knit, you really can learn how to knit very, very fast.
If you wanted to learn how to do your roof, you go onto YouTube and look up how...
And, you know, don't do your own roof. That's what I learned, because I tried that. That was a big fail. the point is that we have so much more opportunity to learn to be creative and engage in a group of people that are interested in the same things. And that, to me, not the revenue aspect of it, but just the human nature aspect of engaging with other people that are interested in what you're interested in, whether it being creative or really engaging in some fictional storyline, whatever it is, that space is really, it's been there from the very beginning of the internet, you know, of message boards around different types of pillows for your bed, right? Mm-hmm. That's always been there, this idea that you can get really engaged and geek out on something. And it's still there, and just a lot more people are able to do it and feel free to do it. And I think that's the blessing, if you will. An atheist uses blessing is funny. Of the internet. He then asks about artificial intelligence and whether big companies are the only ones that can participate in that space. Nope. Artificial intelligence is one of those other things. Now, first off, if you want to actually develop software in the artificial intelligence space, you get a lot of learning to do.
Well, that depends. Yes, you have some learning to do, but there was another story that came by that I wasn't going to cover, which was while, for example, Facebook uses a great deal of machine learning and AI in their tools, 70% of their engineers who are using it don't necessarily know how it works very well. They're not fully trained in that sphere. I think AI in general across the industry, you have a few people that have the training and have the background, that have the strong grounding in statistics, and the coding chops, and, you know,
and right now those people are getting offered very lucrative jobs,
right? And then you have a very large majority of the folks who are in that space that are winging it,
mm-hmm. and I think you can. I think you can wing it.
Yeah. Well, you can wing it until you start to really rely on the answers that come out and not see, because statistics, you know, lies, damn lies and statistics, it's very easy to come up with a very compelling and yet very wrong answer.
Yeah. What I meant by winging it is that if you're interested in the artificial intelligence space, and I use that term to mean a lot of engagement in machines doing smart things. It's hard to define the space because there's all these different tendrils of area. But if you're interested in that, again, you can do a lot of research online. You can take the Stanford free classes on this kind of topic space. You're going to invest a lot of time to understand it well enough to actually start doing development in it. At the same time, it's easier than it ever has been to do that.
Mm-hmm. And thinking in terms of the winging it, I didn't mean it purely in a pejorative manner. Mm-hmm. Because that's how the internet started. Making web pages was not necessarily a bunch of people with computer science degrees or computer engineering degrees. It was a bunch of people learning what they could and winging it. And sometimes you had some horrible results. Some major security flaws have been a result of that. And you know, really bad languages, PHP. But you also have some really wonderful things that have come out of it. It would be hard for me to enumerate them because there are just so many. Most of the things that you see out there, even big companies, were people winging it.
Yeah.
I mean, Apple.
Well,
the founders of Apple were winging it.
Well, Facebook was. I mean, you just downplayed PHP, but of course, Facebook is famously written on PHP,
right,
and still is. Actually.
Right.
Let's go on to another topic point that kind of connects to me, and that is that there's a large article by Nema Jeromi, published October 24th, in, of all places, The New Yorker. And the title is The Uncanny Resurrection of Dungeons & Dragons. And I like that I think it's a she, uses resurrection. I'm a big long-term gamer. Like, I started playing D&D when I was 13. I still have a character from when I was 14 that I play once a year. I was for years every Friday night D&D. I would drive from Los Angeles up to Santa Cruz, which is about a 5.5-hour drive, to play a game of D&D. Campaign, all that thing. Part of the glory of that for me as a young person was feeling a superiority around the jocks because I was engaged in this intellectual debate and thinking how smart I was. I now see the error of that perception of the world as a more mature person, but I still hold this protective love of D&D.
Just what because is something that has virtue doesn't mean that something else lacks it.
That's exactly right, yeah. But I think part of the experience of the bonding around the gaming table was that I wasn't doing the sports stuff, and I didn't have the same kind of home at school that I knew other people did, and then I had my gaming group. And so that gaming group was a space that allowed me to feel like I was a part of something. And because of that, the other is a strengthening aspect of a small group. That's how our dynamics work. But, you know, Stranger Things has become this major hit of Netflix. And in Stranger Things, the kids are playing D&D. And over the years, we've seen D&D pop up. One of the most popular comedians and stand-up hosts and everything is Stephen Colbert. And he famously is a gamer and talks about it every once in a while. When he started quoting it, talking about fighting orcs with halberds and stuff, I would take snippets of that video and send it out to my D&D friends. It was so exciting to have someone in the mainstream talk about D&D.
And Vin Diesel.
Yes, Vin Diesel, big player, sure.
Fun fact, I just wanted to bring this up. The Chronicles of Riddick, the second in that series, Dame Judi Dench is in that movie. And you think, wonder why she did that movie. And it's because Vin Diesel asked her. Now, he didn't really know her. He was getting to know her, and apparently, the conversation went, hey, come over to my house and we'll play some D&D.
Yes.
Vin Diesel playing D&D with Dame Judi Dench, and at the end of that experience, she agrees to be in a movie with him. I really wanted to see that game. I wanted to be a fly on the wall so much.
And Drew Barrymore also plays D&D. And of course, there's this reincarnation. I mean, one of the most popular movies out there, right, or television shows right there, is Game of Thrones, which is completely a D&D world. I mean, that in some ways, when I was reading those books when I was playing regularly and thinking the entire time, oh yeah, this seems fantastic. In fact, I have in my D&D, my universe that I created when I was a game master, the cities are named after the Game of Thrones cities. And this is before my friends had read the Game of Thrones. I just happened to read those books. And so then I started using those words or using those cities. And now, of course, those are famous storylines. My cities and Game of Thrones have nothing to do with each other except for their names. But the aspect of D&D, so I have this kind of like protective feeling of privacy around D&D in some level. And it's now, there's a friggin' New Yorker article about it. It's this mainstream thing now and everybody's doing it.
There's also this cultural aspect of it, because really you have the general cultural affair, and then you had Tolkien, who kind of codified a lot of fairy tales and legends from the past and kind of coalesced them together and gave them names. And from there you have things like D&D, which took that foundation that was made essentially by Tolkien.
Oh, Gygax says that he took, D&D is Tolkien universe incarnate.
And and then putting it onto a strategic model, like a math-based model.
So the other thing about role-playing games, yeah, the other thing about role-playing games is they're very tied into understanding warfare. I mean, the reason why, like the history of role-playing games and dice system games that are emulating combat is to deal with generals being trained for how to manage war. Like mm-hmm. it is war games. I think that at some level D&D became this more complex thing. Like when I was, I mean, we were gaming, we're doing it in character, right? You, not necessarily do a voice, but you definitely take on a persona. And maybe I should be more clear to what D&D actually is like, but I think since it's becoming so popular, I don't have to really describe it. And we have, in our archives, we have episodes about D&D, I'm sure. But the success of it right now is interesting in a couple ways. You can, of course, play online with people. There are really successful podcasts right now that are just people playing D&D games or other role-playing games. But there's another wonderful aspect of it is that so much of our interactions through computer means, so much of our games are computer games, and yet this is get together with a group of people and have a story conversation. Because really, all this is so structured stories. Though,
actually, I thought it was a very logical progression from when you and I and others were sitting around a room on our computers playing Diablo 2.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that seemed like a natural progression to
you. You mean like go role-playing game, then Diablo 2?
Yeah.
Yeah. At some level it was, but...
No, I realized that it wasn't the open-end story. You didn't have that interaction there. I was just thinking in terms of you had this probabilistic model for D&D, and then, all right, let's take away all of the die rolls.
Yeah, but I mean the reason why Diablo got created is because D&D existed. Like, just an emulation exactly. of that, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But that's not... I don't think of that as a better experience. It's just a different experience.
Well, no, D&D isn't a better experience than reading Tolkien.
It's like playing tennis and playing ping pong. They're just different games.
They're evolutions along the continuum that make its own culture.
Yes. The culture aspect of it. So it's interesting because, you know, we start this radio program and we're these experts in technology. Now everybody's an expert in technology. Like the level that we knew at that point, of course we've kept up and everything. But, you know, at one point I knew about role-playing games and I was an expert of that. And that was like something I owned in this kind of perspective of like having a fascination with something and really understanding it really well. And now it's mainstream. It feels like, and of course comic books are another great example of this. It used to be that the geek that was talking about comic books was this person that read by themselves and knew all this collection, all that. Now freaking people know all the superheroes. It's so frustrating. And of course the superheroes are slightly wrong, you know. No, Wolverine should have died when his heart was punctured. But, you know, but the little secret space that I had as a geeky high school kid is now everywhere around me. And it's a little weird to be in that space where it's all extremely popular now. Yeah. I don't feel like there's any...
That's where some of the badness has come from society as well. You touched on it a little bit when you said this was my space and it wasn't the jocks, you know, that type of thing. Because we did grow up in a time where nerds were not... Before the dot-com boom, before there was the money to be made,
we weren't sexy.
Yeah, nerds were not sexy. Computers were not sexy. And as much as they are now.
It is true. It's true because now, you know, I run into somebody like, oh, what do you do for a living? Like, I'm a programmer. Oh, what do you make? Oh, I work on the Netflix iPhone app. If you've got an iPhone and use Netflix, that's what I do. And they're like, oh. It's like this magical thing, right? And it used to be like...
It's a prestige thing.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And like when you and I met, you know, what do you do? Oh, we make websites for radio stations. And they're like, oh, okay. Like there wasn't that much excitement around it, you know?
Well, I was thinking like earlier than that, like before we became professionals too, but if... Like, oh, we spent time on computers and I made this basic program.
Don't talk to me anymore.
Yeah, okay. But there was this... persecution aspect of this model that came in early on that had some merit, you know, 25 years ago or something like that. And it's been taken along all the way. So now, you know, the nerds are the richest people in the world. and yet they still
have this collectively chip on their shoulder,
there's a cultural chip on their shoulder to say like this fighting the inferiority complex, like, oh, the jocks are... But at the same time, he's like, no, you have all the power now. You're the ones who are in charge. You have the power to be the bully now.
Right. And many times have inherited those.
Have been, yeah.
I agree, that's a curious flip over. There's a bit of that being stuck with us, you know, that feeling from our childhood kind of sticking through. And there's a bit of a chip on the shoulder, I think, still. And it also, of course, is... You know, at one point, it was extremely important for human beings to have to be strong and have, you know, physical abilities.
Well, in many ways, it still is, but yeah, yeah.
But in a lot of, you know, at you know pre-industrial revolution, the strongest person was a very well-respected person because they could do more work on the farm. Like in the society where strength was important, manual labor was important.
Wait, what time are you thinking about?
I'm talking pre-industrial revolution. But you know, over time, the hardworking person is physically enduring a lot, whether it's, you know, taking care of a giant house, whether it's out working and doing mm-hmm. things, you're managing animals, you're, you know, moving bales of hay. I mean, talking about kind of farm work, but in general, over time, as we've shifted to more and more the intellectual domain of economy based, that quality has become less and less important in our society. And we're seeing that now. If you want to be extremely wealthy and, you know, quote, successful, just get into law and become a finance person, right? Intellectual, strength's not important. Of course, physical stature and being a male is actually probably still important, unfortunately. But I see that where we are of like from our, you know, early 80s childhood to now is drastically different how society is. And we kind of fell into a lucky spot in doing that, I would say.
Perhaps.
Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use their stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that the geeks made it. Geekspeak's theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And today's title is Big Tablets Change Russian Dungeons by Greg Merkley. Thank you for the title. And in the air with me today, I'm Lyle Troxell, and I was speaking with Miles Elam. Miles, thanks so much for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
You too can support our program. Just visit geekspeak.org/support, as did these wonderful fine people who donate money every month to keep our program going and to invite new people to listen. Thank you to Chris Irwin, Pat Hedder, Jeremy Devine, Jim Warner, Glenn Nelson, Luke Pigeon, John Winston, Dave Holloway, David Leap, Alex Chen, Nirajis Clenius, Marcus Hall, Zach Smithson, John Vizana, Mike Coopersmith, Christy Ramsey, Spider Rogue, Ted Mazo, Brandon Holloway, Joe Kyle, Ben Powell, Adam K. Foodie, Judy Anos, and also like seven other people who chose not to be named. I want to thank you all very much for supporting Geekspeak. With your contributions in this last cycle, we ran an ad on podcasting platform, and I would like to welcome 240 new subscribers. So welcome to our program. I hope you enjoy. We got to keep going on this conversation. It's too interesting. I love that you didn't like my wrap-up of that. I can tell you want to say more. You don't think that there's like this kind of change in how about humans respecting strength, physical versus intellectual?
I think that pre-industrial revolution, the mercantile class was not necessarily the biggest and the strongest.
It's always been that the people with power weren't necessarily physically strong?
The most physically strong being the ones who were in charge, I don't know if that was ever actually a universal truth.
Except for maybe in nomadic societies.
Even there. Like,
yeah, I don't know enough about anthropology to never really know.
Because the very strongest is not necessarily the best leader or the, you know, the best equipped to handle different situations.
Sure.
They were valued, but I don't know that there actually was a time where you could point and say, yeah, the strongest person is the one in charge.
I had a conversation with somebody recently about the sexism that at Google. About other places too, but I brought Google because I used to work there. Do you see this kind of male sexism space in the technology space being associated with this geeky rebirth space? Meaning, you know, you're kind of an outcast in high school. You're spending all this time on your computer. You're being pressured and bullied, and you don't feel like you connect and interact. You're playing D&D with your friends, and then I'm talking about a guy, group of D&D people, and then you grow up and become a software engineer, and then you get into the software space, and it becomes mainstream, and you start getting resentful and pointing fingers at other people and not feeling... I mean, is that connected in some way? I don't really understand.
I honestly believe that that's a completely lame excuse. I don't know that it... I don't necessarily mean that a person may not have that pathos in their mind, but I don't think that for the vast majority of people that are out there, that it's actually reflecting reality.
It's not about reality though. It's about perception. Like when I started earlier saying, you know, I felt like D&D was kind of my private space, and now it's mainstream. And I kind of just had this weird chip on my shoulder of like, hey, that was mine. That aspect, I see that in myself as being kind of stupid and ridiculous, but at the same time, I feel it at some level. And I'm wondering if those people that are feeling that aspect of sexism that they're representing in their workspace, if that's where that's coming from, that same kind of resentmental thing.
Yeah, that's taking a claim to something and proclaiming it yours.
Yeah.
is absolutely the case. You may have women that have been gaming as long or longer than they have, but for some reason there's this toxic subculture of men who believe that gaming belongs to them.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's the whole Gamergate thing, right?
Yeah, which is, I mean,
which is ridiculous,
completely ahistorical, but it still happens. I don't know where to go with that. That ownership, laying ownership to something and then saying, no, you're not allowed to do that because it violates my own perceptions of what it is.
I have to say that using gamer to represent a computer person, it just still irks me. A gamer is someone that has dice and pencils and D&D books and knows what a halberd is, God damn it. So...
In other words, you are laying claim to something.
No, and... I mean, I know it's gone. I know it's past. I know gamer represents anybody that plays.
It's not necessarily past. It's just like it hasn't passed. It's merely expanded to mean different things to different people, sure. Which is what happens to any item. I mean, that's the whole thing with Marvel. Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's like, no, it's a whole new
audience. I think that gamer at this point, like if you were to have a definition of what the term gamer meant. It would definitely include computer games. I don't think
it's like computer used to be the person who,
right, exactly,
did stuff on paper.
So you think that there's some kind of merit in my grasping at straws idea to try to understand the sexist programmer? That might be part of the rationale, is that they feel some kind of ownership around a space.
There's that, but there's also just the fact that sexism is pervasive in our society.
Sure. Right. And it's going to come in every
course,
field.
Of course it's going to show up everywhere. I mean, how often do you look at a Hollywood movie and see, like, if you are successful and, you know, or if you are smarter, if you're a good person, then you get the beautiful girl as a prize. Like, how often does that trope show up?
Right.
And of course it's going to affect society and the people who grow up in that environment, both men and women.
Well, I think we handled Letter from John pretty well, and we talked a little bit about Dungeons and Dragons.
Or at least we handled it.
We answered it. We talked about it. What did I say?
No, we handled it well. And I said, okay. Well, we handled it.
Thanks. Nice. Be careful of visiting websites for a completely new reason. Tell me what's going on now.
It has always been the case that if you went to the wrong site and downloaded the wrong program, you may end up with a virus on your system. It's how botnets sure. show up.
That sounds like Geek Speak from 10 years ago.
Exactly. Right. Now you can go to the wrong site or download the wrong app, and it'll use your excess CPU power to mine cryptocurrency so that they can give themselves more Bitcoin.
And they can actually do this just with JavaScript without breaking any security rules or anything, because
right, it's just number, it's yeah. just numerics.
Yeah, I think that a few browsers now are reducing the processing speed, processing cycles to tabs that are in the background, so that's beneficial.
Yes, but if you combine it with some activity or
a game,
then all you know is, wow, my fan is really cranking when I play this.
If you have your fan really cranking and you're not doing much but like looking through websites, there's something wrong.
No, the thing is, modern computers, there's, I'll see like, oh, Spotlight's indexing again. Like, sure. Oh, yeah. There's some indexing thing going on.
You know, I used to turn off Spotlight indexing. I don't do that anymore.
It is absolutely impossible for the typical person to know why their computer is doing a particular thing at any given moment or time. Like, I really have a lot of sympathy for folks who are coming up with computers as they exist right now, because I know
a lot about them.
Yeah, I know, like, oh, my fan is going. Let me open up Activity Monitor, and I'm going to, or if I'm on a Linux box, like, oh, let me do PSAUX. Let me see,
yeah, but
let me open
even
up
if
top,
you do that and it's Chrome, that doesn't help you. You just know that one of the web pages you have open is doing something.
Sure it does, because a lot of times I'll be like, wait, that's a runaway process. I wonder what's going on. And if I can't immediately think of which one it is, I killed that process, and Chrome is written in such a way with multi-process that a tab just goes like,
goes dark.
Yeah. Like, and you go over and you hit refresh and you see what it is. And you're like, huh, what's going on with that? Like, I can diagnose. And go in.
But yeah, try to explain that on the phone.
Or no, like, have someone even recognize that something is happening. A lot of times
you're saying you are still elite. But the thing is,
yes, I do this as my day job. And so debugging problems is what I do.
Do you use, what do you use for like your IDE?
IDE?
What?
I have to be honest. For the most part, I've been using just a text editor.
Yeah. What text editor?
Text Wrangler.
Yeah? Really? Yeah. Text Wrangler?
Yeah.
Dude, talk about throwbacks, man. Why not BB Edit? Because you'd want to pay for it.
What I look for is I was writing a Node program. I want syntax highlighting. Makes it easier to see where things are and where there's an error. If I click on a variable, it underlines if that text shows up elsewhere. And so I'll know. That's my cue now to know, like, wait, does this variable exist elsewhere or doesn't? Yeah. And most of the things that I have used an IDE for in the past are done by various other tools. NodeMon allows me to, you know, as soon as I make a save, Node restarts and goes right. So it really is a save refresh cycle right there without needing an IDE for it. I have, you know.
Are you doing any Java development?
Not right now.
Where do you do Java development? Eclipse?
I use NetBeans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's. I've used various ones over time.
MS Code is really great. Microsoft's Code.
I downloaded it, I tried it, and was just like, no.
Yeah. So I tried that for a while, but switched back to Sublime. That's the one I'm using mostly for just text editing, which is very similar to Text Wrangler. But that's use IntelliJ because I'm doing so much Groovy development and Java development. And we were talking about runaway processes. I had this problem with IntelliJ where it would just spin up and then it would just keep going. Just 400% CPU cycles because there's multiple processes in this machine. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what is it doing? Nothing. It's not doing anything. And then it wouldn't respond. I have to kill it. And I finally, I spent, you know, 4 or 5 days trying to get this thing working. And other people had the problem. I finally just had to stop using it. Like, I use it when I need to, but mostly I just use text editor because friggin' processor runaways. And how do you solve somebody else's software? You can't really.
Yeah, part of my thing now, and some of it could have been done by an IDE, but right now I run my NPM test and I set it up to run my Mocha unit tests and run ESLint. And ESLint catches, you know, like, I'm doing my coding. I'm like, okay, does this work? And I do ESLint. Like, hey, you've got all these problems there. And a lot of them are spacing issues.
Do you have ESLint as a text editor plugin or something?
No, it's just.
Just after you
it's
run.
It's part of NPM tests. I tell it in my package JSON to say run ESLint period and Mocha.
Right. And then in your console out, you see those notes about spacing and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds pretty nice.
And so that's just what I do, and it catches most of my bugs, and I'm like, okay. And most of the times when it's just a formatting problem where a variable doesn't exist, you can tell it to, you know, dash dash fix, and it, all right.
Yeah. Are you using more advanced JavaScript features?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm coding on Node 8, 8.x, you know, where I think it's on 8.7 now.
So glad it's whole numbers now.
And yeah, I
do you like destructuring?
Yeah. I am using most of the features in there on this project that I'm on. It's really curious that I've actually been touching now just about everything. I have async await. I have to be honest. I've been coding JavaScript for so many years, and this is the first project where I've gone, you know what? I need a generator right now. A generator function. And
why specifically? You mean because you've never programmed in JavaScript as a large application app?
No, I mean I've never had need of a generator function before.
Why not?
Something that, you know, you start up and you yield and just has, I've never had a need for that. Like the things that I've seen as examples are things like the cookie cutter ones are giving a random number, but I can just call math.random over and over again, or crypto random bytes over and over again. That's, I don't need a generator function for that.
What are you using generator function for now?
For a counter, but I need multiple counters. And so each one ends up keeping its state to go plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one.
So you have a generator to make the counters?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Cool.
What's
the difference between a generator and a factory?
Oh, quite a few differences. a generator function in JavaScript is something where, like, say you have a for loop, you're using the yield statement to yield a value, but the state of that loop or whatever structure continues. A factory is something where you are not calling a constructor directly. You want some object, but the construction of it is defined elsewhere.
When you described your counters and using generator for your counters, you were getting multiples of them, and that's why I was wondering if you're using a factory pattern to get your generators, to get your counter generator.
It's closer to an iterator pattern. Oh, okay. So it's next value. Okay. So yeah, it's iterator pattern.
But you have to make multiples of these, right?
Yes, for each.
You're just making
each of the objects has its own counter, so that's why you make a generator function that, you know, the iterator for each one is separate, and so they each have a different number that comes up from the counter.
Right, cool. That got a little geeky. We got one more story about saying goodbye to this thing we both loved for quite a while.
Goodbye, Firebug.
Now, Firebug was magic, man.
Just if you're magic. A youngin', you may not realize this, but
talk Firebug about programming JavaScript.
Firebug changed everything.
Describe what Firebug was. Well, actually, you can, if you have Chrome, you can see what Firebug was.
Right. If you use a JavaScript inspector, if you like do inspect page on Safari or Chrome or Brave or Firefox, those all came from Firebug. Firebug was the original. It was an extension to Firefox way back in the day.
Which gave you access to the runtime.
Yeah.
The JavaScript runtime.
Where you could set breakpoints and work with it.
And this is...
And CSS, to be able to just flip values and see them immediately on the page.
And that's now built into all browsers. But, you know, that's something that I think I showed this to my kids so they understand how to do this. And now they play with it all the time. Mm-hmm. And they'll, like, mess with their teachers. Be like, no, you wrote this. And the teacher will be like, what? Because they hack the page. You know, if you're not familiar with programming and you want to just play a little bit, you have an amazingly good IDE kind of environment all the time in your browser, and it's available to you all the time. And all you have to do is like right click on a web page and say inspect, and you're going to get access to a console that allows you to type JavaScript and do things in it.
Now, modern day inspectors are much more powerful than Firebug was. I mean,
If you really go advanced on what like Chrome can do in that space, it's incredible. You can use it as your full editor.
Actually, Firefox has things like if you want to do grid layout in CSS, it's got a grid.
It has that built in?
Yeah. You can make your grids visually.
Wow.
Aligning stuff.
It's pretty cool. And then it's spitting out CSS for you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Anyway, it's almost kind of like an IDE by itself. When I was doing, when I first started at Netflix, we were doing, I was doing the iOS app, but it was a web app. And so I was always programming JavaScript and HTML. Like, that's what I was doing, CSS and HTML. That's why I was hired. I was an expert in that. And so for, you know, 2 years, I just did a lot of development in browser because all the work we were doing was inside Chrome or inside Safari, depending. And then, you know, the last minute that was packaged up around an app. But for the last 3 years, I've only been doing Objective-C. We went native, and I haven't been doing that at all. And so now when I look at JavaScript, I don't recognize it as much, right? Because it's got all these wonderful... I'm now, you know, it's got all these wonderful features. Now, I remember when I was doing the before working at Netflix, I was doing kind of a talk circuits, and I was, you know, speaking at conferences about JavaScript and kind of really enveloped in it. And that's why I kind of knew it so well. And at the time, we talked about these new features we'd have. But seeing them now just completely in production, and of course, sometimes I have to touch the other apps at Netflix, and the other apps are actually still JavaScript apps. And so I see those features and how people are using it. And I was reading someone's, you know, promise loop function mm-hmm. thing they were doing. I'm like, what is going on here? I just didn't even recognize the language. It was great. So I'm kind of looking forward to we're switching our back end, our middle tier system into JavaScript. So I'll be doing a lot more JavaScript again, which will be nice.
Yeah. I have to say, I feel quite comfortable with the newest levels of JavaScript.
What are you enjoying in that? Did you listen to the show with Joffer and me a while back?
I didn't.
You should listen to it. I mean, the thing is, we talk most about his career and a bit about some stuff that you already know, but then he talks about the pipe function. You know about the pipe function?
The pipe function within Node?
No, so no, not pipes, but there's a discussion right now about this new operator, which is, I think they're calling it pipe. But effectively what it does is inverts the pattern that you're calling functions to functions with. So imagine you're doing like a map and then a filter.
Mm-hmm.
You should really listen to his description of it. It's a little bit better than this. You normally would, the way your calling pattern is, you kind of have to read these functions from right to left because the way you have to pass the function into the other function and the other function, really the first one gets executed. So that the pattern flow is actually inverted from what's really going on. So the pipe basically inverts the way the function gets called.
I'd have to see it.
You have to see it, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, destructuring, being able to like...
So destructuring really is taking some variable definitions on the left side and an object on the right side and just saying equals. And you're basically doing a deep level assignment of properties in an object to variables locally. Is that a good way to describe it?
Well, think of it as I like to think in terms of the practical value of if I return an array from a function, that means that I can declare variables that are members of that array, you know, instead of ever having to deal with this, the first value, index 0, is going to be this item and index 1 is going to be this item. You can just assign names into an array to destructure it. The same thing can be done with objects. So if you're returning an object, you can say, I only care about these three values within it and name them, and then you have them available as those variables.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Being able to swap values.
How do you swap values?
Hold on. I know it's not that big of a deal because in the past, if you had, let's say, an array of two items.
Yeah, but let's say
wanted to, put the one in the second spot into the first spot, and the one in the first spot into the second spot. You create a temporary variable. You copy the first one into the temporary variable, the second one in the first one, temporary back into the second one.
Right.
Now you can simply say, open bracket.
It's kind of like a destructor.
Destructor. It is a destructor. Yeah.
Cool. So you kind of have two things, two arrays, on both sides of an equal sign, and they kind of flop the values.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's pretty cool. So Firebug is going away?
Yeah, it's no longer being developed. It's goodbye. It's no longer supported in the newest version of Firefox.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, I mean,
whatever.
Its time has passed,
yeah.
And I was, very glad to have had it. I believe it showed up around 2009. I don't remember the exact date.
I don't either.
But,
I remember it being kind of around the space when I first saw, what was it before jQuery? That animation framework.
Animation framework.
Well,
I knew that before jQuery you had Prototype.
Oh, was Prototype before jQuery?
Oh, yeah.
Now, this was like a JavaScript framework that allowed you to do simple animation stuff with it.
Oh, you're talking about processing.
No. Processing's awesome. Still around. And processing at that time was Java-based. Now it's also JavaScript-based.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there's some great tutorials on processing.
Sorry, just as a correction. Firebug came out in 2005.
I think it's delicious. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I did never use it.
It was horrible. Still, it's probably being developed still. It's time to plug in the car. That was my alarm to say plug in the car, which means that it's 9:10, which means that you and I have to stop doing Geek Speak right now.
All right.
Thank you so much, Miles, for joining me.
Always a pleasure.